Ah, the eye-popping special effects! In honor of Blade Runner 2049, or maybe the original Blade Runner, what's the best-looking bad movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with a previous collaboration between Prisoners director Denis Villeneuve and cinematographer Roger Deakins, which is Prisoners, which sucks, but looks
terrible.
Great.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with a 3D film that burned my eyes out that I have to admit I can look at Blu-ray images of this movie and be impressed. It's Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I feel like I always say this disclaimer that this can't be the ultimate answer, but this is the one that popped to mind, which is The Matrix Reloaded. Not The Matrix Revolutions, which I remember as being a very ugly movie, but the Matrix-y scenes, you know, when they're in The Matrix, from The Matrix Reloaded, look great. That movie's hot garbage. So I'm going to go with that one.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 183, and it's Tuesday, October 3rd, and this is a good one. On this day in 1995, O.J. Simpson was acquitted of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman.
Good one.
Where were you? Do you guys remember where you were when this came through?
I think I was in fourth grade. Sydney, I remember my teacher turned on The Judgment, and we were sitting
they
in
class. They call it a verdict. Down.
I call it a judgment or failure to judge. How do humans talk?
Yeah, they wheeled a TV into my sixth grade classroom so we could watch it, which is crazy to think about. Who, like, why did they?
I mean, that's for the teachers, not you, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't think I had that much awareness of what was going on.
David, where were you?
I must have been in grade school. I do remember them wheeling in TVs from time to time during the trial. I don't remember the day the verdict came down itself. But that sounds about right. Yeah.
I learned most about the O.J. Simpson trial from SNL reruns on Comedy Central later. Where Mike Myers played Judge Ito.
Yeah, that wouldn't work now. Yeah, they wouldn't get away with that now.
No.
Okay. This week, as you might be able to tell, we've lost Dave. He'll be back. He's just not with us this week exactly. And I'm very proud of myself for coming up with this day in history. And I also hear that we have a new review to share.
We have a new review to share from Al Sneakers, who says, "It's a podcast. Best film podcast for scrappy debate and measured snark. I like the topic discussions best, as few other film podcasts step outside of the review interview format. At its best, the show feels like a weekly magazine, bringing together different personalities from the world of online film criticism. In a world where newspaper critics don't have the same cachet and there are no big TV shows like Siskel and Ebert driving the cultural conversation, this show makes the film world feel connected and exciting. Thank you, Al Sneakers." I like the image of us measuring our snark carefully in beakers before we record every episode.
The perfect dose.
Yes, and for putting that image in my mind, I'm going to say that this review was most helpful.
Yeah. So I hear we have an incentive to try and get some more reviews on the board.
Well, it's not in. Well, that sounds crass. You know, that's a cheap ploy. No, we're giving away a Blu-ray copy, actually two Blu-ray copies of A Ghost Story, a phenomenal movie. I think we all agree. Well, Katie, you didn't see it. You
haven't seen it, but I hear it's on Blu-ray.
Win it.
So yeah, can I enter?
Phenomenal movie.
No. David and I love this movie. David Lowery's little micro budget side. Or post Pete's Dragon project kind of blew us away at Sundance, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it at the end of the year. No one for the Oscars, but us smart lads will be discussing it in our top 10. I'm sure. Well, I hope. David, hints?
Yeah, it's looking likely.
Right. It's pretty locked. But you could win this movie on Blu-ray and see it the right way if you leave a review this week. We're gonna give you 1 week to jot it down. I guess if you have before, you could update an old review and get the gears cranking, get some new feelings out there. And that's the key. When you leave your review, if you're leaving a Ghost Story prize winning review, you know, give us the feels. Tell us about a movie that really moved you the way a Ghost Story moved us. And perhaps if we've talked about it on the podcast, you can maybe our episode moved you as well. loop it all together, put it on iTunes paper and file it under Fighting in the War Room's iTunes page, and we'll get to you. And perhaps if you, this is an American competition only. I'm sorry to all our international listeners, but we encourage everyone to leave reviews. Last week, we read some out of the U.S. reviews that we were given the heads up on Twitter and Facebook by people. So even if you can't enter a Ghost Story Blu-ray giveaway, leave us a review from wherever you are and give us a heads up, and we'll read it here. So that's right. That. 1 week, a ghost story.
Get reviewing.
Reviews. Do it.
It's the dream.
So the day we're recording this is the day, I guess maybe the day after the shooting in Las Vegas, that I think at this point that's kind of all you have to say and people know what you're talking about.
Although I'm sure there were several, but I think
who knows
one to which we're referring.
By the time you hear this, there may have well been another one, which is kind of what we wanted to talk about. I think, you know, there is the horror and shock and disappointment and, you know, maybe fear that goes along with all of these. But then you kind of get people talking about how, like, they can't believe that we're talking about this again. And, like, we're back here. And, yes, it's yet again the deadliest shooting in American history. But today while I was reading the news, I kind of realized I didn't feel surprised. Like, I think on some level I always operate under the base assumption that something like this is going to happen again. And, you know, God willing, it won't involve me or anyone I know. But I don't feel a surprise about it, which I think is taking away from some of the revulsion and horror. And I wonder if you guys are feeling this way too, that like as horrible a news as it is, it's starting to feel like part of what American life is.
Yeah, I think, well, before the podcast, we were talking a little about that we've been on this podcast talking about these types of incidents and feeling like we've now gone into movies and felt disturbed by the imagery we see on screen. You know, we're recalling these horrific incidents, and movies with excessive violence can bring back those memories. And it's also terrifying. But now I agree with you. I just feel totally desensitized. We see this imagery all the time, no longer in the movies, just everywhere. It's constant conversation. It's all, and then it becomes infotainment, right? It's reprocessed by all sides of this conversation. Of course, there's like the Alex Joneses of the world who are turning it into true pop infotainment for their followers and conspiracy theories, and they treat it like television. It's a new incident. It's the latest recap. Here are the theories. I mean, it's madness. But then, you know, everybody who's partaking in the conversation has this too. It's like it's not a real incident. It's the discussion to be had. I'm not saying that we shouldn't politicize these sort of things, but like when it's rapid fire on Twitter, I guess that's the poor choice of words, but just like the constant chatter about it, when it's the same means you're using to talk about movies or talk about whatever, I don't know. It's just, it comes this swirl of thoughts and this continuous drone. How do you make it important when it feels like another episode in the saga? It's crazy.
And it feels like it'll happen again next week.
And you know it will happen again.
I mean, there have been almost as many mass shootings this year, obviously not all on the scale or any on the scale, because there's never been one of the scale, but there have been mass shootings, as many mass shootings this year as there have been days this year. So yes, it will happen again. I think there already was a mass shooting earlier today in Massachusetts. Obviously many fewer victims, but still a mass shooting, and the fact that we even have to qualify that is a pretty damning indictment of the current state of things. But I do have to say, I don't find myself desensitized to this, and I'm not gonna, like, lord that over anyone else, suggest that I'm somehow, I mean, there are so many things out there that happen in the world that I am not as sensitive to, and I will, I don't know. Empathy is a fun. I'm not saying you guys aren't empathetic of these things, of course. But,
no, I think you are saying that you're a better person than us, which I can't argue.
No, I'm not. No, I mean, like, there are some things that people get desensitized to, and there's some that they don't. I think it speaks to not just the empathy that I assume we all have for victims of any senseless violence or tragedy, but our particular fears as well. I think something like plane crashes and random shootings happen to, maybe it is the randomness of them all, but they really, I want to say trigger, but no pun intended. It's just a word that sprang to mind. Something in me that keeps me up at night. But I think the thing, as much as anything, that prevents me from being desensitized to this, that really, really shook me up about this and will continue to for a long time is the sort of momentum of all of these things happening and the gathering storm of feeling like there is no turning back, that this is the culture that we've made for ourselves and we're sort of doomed to live with the consequences and that we're just barreling towards darkness. What was the movie I was thinking? Oh, the new Paul Schrader film, which I won't talk about at length because it's not out yet, although it did just get out at the New York Film Festival lineup. That is about global warming and a priest who is, Ethan Hawke plays a priest who's counseling a young man who is very, he's dating Amanda Seyfried, they're married to Amanda Seyfried, and he's talking about how he doesn't feel comfortable bringing new life into this world because he is getting really caught up in what's happening with climate change and feels irresponsible given what we've done to this planet, what the future portends, bringing new life into the world. And Ethan Hawke, those thoughts resonate with him and his character, and he grapples with them in very extreme ways over the rest of the film. And I think it's time that we start making a lot more movies like that, because those are questions that we all have to wrestle with. But, I mean, the sheer insanity of the right in this country right now, and the people like, you know, Alex Jones and anybody in the right wing media, you know, but our president, for God's sakes, whipping people up into a frenzy. It just seems like a slippery slope that we've been sliding on our asses down for a long, long time now, and we're only picking up speed as we hurtle towards the bottom. And the accumulation of that feeling, I think, is what prevents me from getting desensitized to it, and why I don't know, I've always found the argument that we can be desensitized to media to be a little bit specious.
Well, I don't know if desensitized is really the right word. I mean, this incident makes my stomach turn, and I try not to add to the noise because everyone's sharing my thoughts. It's sickening. And I'm on some level, I'm happy that most of the people I know in this world kind of agree with me and want to see some change and want to do something about it. I guess the question, it's not desensitizing. It's a helplessness, right? Or that the image, and to kind of put it on terms of something that we would normally talk about on this podcast, what is the power of an image when you see it over and over and over again? I mean, we complain about, I don't want to equate the horrific incidents with like Marvel movies here, but on some level, we complain about seeing the same, you know, set pieces in a big action movie over and over and over again, and they've completely lost flavor. We don't tune into them. We kind of like coast through them. But the image of a gun, the image of a gun has lost impact.
I think it's totally fair to conflate these things, if only because to our brains, you know, especially if we don't personally know people who were immediately affected by these incidents, they all are sort of the same sort of external media. I mean, we are smart enough to recognize that what we see on a movie screen within the context of fictional entertainment is not the same thing we see in a news report, which, contrary to what a lot of the more dangerous elements in this country would tell you, are not fictional elements. But what's interesting about this particular mass shooting is that I have not engaged with it in a visual way at all. I mean, it happened in the middle of the night, especially for us over in the East Coast. There is, I'm sure, all sorts of cell phone video and camera and whatnot.
Yeah, there's quite a bit. And I'm with you. I also have not, I haven't even looked, I turned on New York Times app this morning and saw that what had happened and that the images were there. I can't even look at that.
Only thing that I saw, and that it really sickened me, because it's really the only thing that I've looked at, was a illustrated diagram showing the distance between the concert venue and where the crowds were and the 32nd floor or whatever it was of the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and really visualizing for myself what 1,200 feet of distance looks like, and the idea that somebody could be that far away, so many football fields away, with a weapon that he bought over the counter, still injure more than 500 people and murder 58 of them. I mean, like that so boggles my mind, that we could have gotten to a place where this is even possible, let alone, encouraged by an element of our society. Not the murder part necessarily, but all the things that made it possible. That really resonated with me, but I haven't been, and I feel like a lot of people, this has been a I don't know. There's nothing more to see in a certain way. I was watching the Denis Villeneuve film Polytechnique this weekend because I was writing about all of his movies, and this is a movie that he made in 2009 about a mass shooting that happened in 1989 in the Polytechnique Institute, I believe, is in Quebec. If it's in Montreal, I'm very, very sorry. And it's very much sort of like the French-Canadian response to Elephant, even though the incident in the film takes place before Columbine. And I'm just thinking, like, we have so many images of this random slaughter now, particularly with assault rifles. I don't know if we're just sort of full up on them now, and if something like this happens, we can go immediately to the talking points.
But that's what seems like it's the power of the image that really moves people, right? Facts, we're beyond facts. So, like, what? It has to be something horrific, or it has to be something powerful. It has to be that image. Maybe it's diagrams. Maybe that's the only way to get facts across these days. Or have we completely lost the power of image? I don't know. That's crazy. I mean, that's what it seems to come down to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I think helplessness is a word that you used earlier in the segment, and I think that's really the feeling more than anything else for me, in addition to, I mean, there's only so scared you can be about going into crowded places in your daily life. There is a sense of helplessness. There's a sense of the worst of our nature, the worst angels of our nature, to borrow and invert, you know, Abraham Lincoln's famous turn of phrase, have completely taken over. And for no reason, our entire society and the safety of everybody in it has been hijacked by a for-profit fringe group of lunatics, and there's nothing we can do about it, even though it seems so inexplicable that we should be so helpless. And that feeling of just, you know, howling into the void because there's nothing else we can do, I don't know. That's something, like, how do you depict that in an image? How would we process that in entertainment? How would we resensitize ourselves if we are desensitized to it? I don't know.
I want to ask you guys, maybe this is a way to wrap up the segment, and maybe you don't want to weigh on this at all because it's an argument starter, but I feel like I am comfortable with banning guns completely. Like, figure out, like, a constitutional amendment or get a Supreme Court case to challenge the Second Amendment.
But,
like,
that's only worked in every single place they've ever tried it, so I'm not sure.
I know a lot of people, like, you know, want more restrictions or want, you know, obviously banning assault rifles is something I think we'd all agree on, but, like, I would be happy with zero guns, period. Where do you guys stand on that?
I mean, it just doesn't seem very realistic.
I'm not talking about plausible. I'm just talking about, like, what you morally would support an effort.
Oh, I mean.
Yeah, but what about what I want to go out into the woods of Alaska and elude my secret security detail and murder a moose? I mean,
did he murder a moose?
Yes, he fucking murdered a moose. That is, and this is Donald Trump Jr., not Donald Trump. I mean, the image of Donald Trump trying to murder anything other than people from a distance is silly. But yeah, I mean, if plausibility be damned, yeah, I mean, in a heartbeat, I would take every gun off the face of the earth. And I think it was the actor from Veep, Timothy Simmons, today was saying, you know, until I wish I had a tweet in front of me, I don't, but he was saying, like, until somebody is able to murder 58 people from a distance of 1,200 feet with a knife, you know, we can talk about that. But until then, you are making the dumbest fucking point on earth. And I think, you know, he's right. But there are ways to do this that are plausible. And we have seen them throughout the world. Australia is a go-to example and a good one for a reason. And it's just, we have decided that, you know, Bill O'Reilly wants to tell you that it's just because this is part of the exchange of our liberties. And Bill O'Reilly's a fucking moron. If he's telling you something like that, you should know enough to be suspicious. But yes, get rid of the fucking guns. Remember the American president, of all things, Aaron Sorkin. He's good for something. He, you know, the speech at the end of the American president is as concise an argument against the fallacy that we need to have these guns, that this was anything that the founding fathers were considering. I mean, my favorite song of Hamilton is definitely the one where they're all getting together and talking about why they need machine gun that can injure more than 500 people in just a few seconds.
How about your favorite song in Hamilton where they describe all the steps they took to load the guns for the duel and you see how elaborate it was?
Oh, right, right. Yes, yes. And that's that takes like fucking 10 minutes. Yeah. It's my least favorite song in Hamilton, but you make a very good point. Ban the fucking guns. Ban the assault rifles for starters. I don't know. Do we not have enough things to worry about? Like, we're on the verge of condemning our entire species with global warming. I mean, this seems like small potatoes next to that, and it should be feasible.
I mean, I just think, I'm thinking back to, there was a documentary last year done on the Newtown shootings, and a lot of it was about the families. It was about the aftermath. It was called Newtown. It's not a great film, but it's definitely striking because of the proximity this filmmaker gets to these families and this pursuit to like make change. And I don't know. I think there's just willful ignorance, right? If you're hearing these people plea, I don't know what the attachment to the gun could mean I don't really know what that means to people.
You and I both know that all those people were crisis actors hired by fucking George Soros to pretend that they had children who were killed. I mean, like, the insanity is so far beyond the pale. My Twitter feed today was filled with people that were like, you know, even Tommy Lahren of all people, who's a, you know, human garbage, but is again, respectable is not the right word. I don't know. She's popular, at least. She's not just some random troll on my Twitter feed. She's just a troll on my Twitter feed. Is saying that there's something's not right about the shooter and the profile that the media has of him, implying that there's some sort of liberal conspiracy behind these
that
things.
That lonely white men have not been known to shoot.
Yes,
people.
No. I mean, it's not, oh, the obvious suspect behind the vast majority of these fucking killings throughout history. I mean, it's so demented.
Well, I'm trying to be a little more level-headed here. It's not that
What's
I
there to be
need.
About?
Well, no. Well, let me finish. That I'm not saying we need guns on this planet. I'm not for them in any way. I'm with you, Katie. You could probably get rid of them, and life would only be better for people. But I'm more curious at this point. That's just like, what's keeping the like 2A proponents? When these images are out there, and if I'm watching this Newtown documentary, watching these parents cry and talking about guns and statistics and looking straight in their eyes as they're like begging people to make change, I don't really know what's keeping people holding on other than this kind of like troll mentality that they don't want to. There's no compromise. The rights of the Constitution stay out of people's way. But like, this is what. This is what news media gives us, this is what documentary film gives us, this is what every day in the aftermath of these moments gives us, like people confessing and begging and just wanting something to change, and there's just, it's mercilessness, right? Like, there's just, why can't there be conversation or compromise? It's just tough to understand. I'm sure there are people listening to this who are pro 2A, and we've pissed them off royally with this conversation, but I just want to know, like, I just want to know, like, why?
I think there are plenty of reasonable people who want reasonable gun control and don't want to ban all guns. Like, I'm not saying the only way to be right is to want to ban guns like we do. So and I've never fired a gun. Like, this is something that, you know, I think it's a fair point.
Well, I actually would recommend that you do.
Oh, yeah. I remember you did that.
Yeah,
you were kind of freaked out by it.
Remember in American Beauty when Peter Gallagher tells Annette Bening to go and fire a gun?
That's right.
Completely opens her up sexually.
It really worked out well for
her. Last year, I shot an AR-15, and it was the scariest experience, one of the scariest experiences of my life. I mean, it's just so easy, and it's terrifying, and it reminds you of playing video games. And it was at a shooting range that was papered with 2A, you know, like pro 2A.
You keep saying 2A. Like, I've never heard this term before today. You mean Second Amendment, but that's very jargony.
2A is very jargony because I'm now on the shooting range's mailing list for some reason. And I get a lot of, like, fight for 2A emails. So that's what, I mean, people, you know, hashtag 2A, look it up. But that's the conversation that people are having. But it's just like, it was so scary. So scary. Great. Anyway.
I don't know. If someone like, what the fuck is this guy's name from the band who, Caleb Keeter. If a ridiculously white country music musician named Caleb Keeter can suddenly decide that he needs to change his mind about gun control, there's still hope for everyone. Of course, Caleb Keeter waited until this, personally affected him until he saw it firsthand. And hopefully it shouldn't have to come to that, but on a long timeline, it will come to that for all of us.
A bunch of congressmen got shot at a baseball game earlier this summer, and nothing happened after that.
Well, I think Congress passed some security measures, some financing for themselves. Security.
Yeah.
Yes, I
for
think
making
that
sure that their
happen.
Baseball games have protection.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I don't know if that happened, but I
no, will, that that happened. That happened. Yeah. But I don't want to get too far into the details. Anyway, I'm sure we're going to talk about some other things. There's hope. There's hope.
On.
We should be hopeful. This segment should end with some hope, right?
Well, I think our next segment is going to bring hope to everybody. This weekend, opening opposite Blade Runner, in what I think is pretty genius counter-programming, Mount Between Us. David, I hear you have an alternate title.
More like The Mountain Between Us, but, you know, it's a very imperceptible homonym here. You just have to notice the slight apostrophe after the N.
So, David, I got to see part of Mount Between Us at Toronto. I had to leave for
lucky you.
Professional reasons. Do they fuck on that mountain?
That it would be telling, Katie. This
Wait,
is not.
Can you back up? Yet. What is The Mountain Between Us about? Yeah, and who is in it? And who is mountain one another on the mountain?
Maybe no one. Maybe everyone. If anyone fucks on Fuck Mountain, it is Idris Elba and Kate Winslet.
The real mountain was love.
Yeah, the real love mountain making. Between them was definitely love. This is a movie that I have described as Alive meets Before Sunrise, which I hope that was a board meeting and that somebody or an elevator pitch that somebody had. It was.
I feel like that's overpromising the quality of this movie, having seen an hour of it.
Definitely qualitatively, although I don't remember how good Alive was. It definitely overpromises on the cannibalism in this movie, but they are stranded on a plane in the mountain. The premise is set up very, very, very quickly. Within the first 10 minutes of the movie, Idris Elba and Kate Winslet meet in an airport somewhere out west. They both have to get back to New York City in advance of a snowstorm that has canceled all the flights out of that particular airport. Kate Winslet is getting married the next day, but she's been traveling. She's a war photographer. More like a conflict zone photographer. Idris Elba, more inexplicably, is traveling because he is a neurosurgeon performing surgery on a 10-year-old boy in New York the next day. I am not a neurosurgeon. I think you've noticed that. But I would have to imagine that, barring extenuating circumstances, which are not mentioned in the movie, you don't fly into the place where you're performing delicate neurosurgery like the night before because these things require some planning. I don't know. I just didn't buy that. Anyway, their flight's canceled. Kate Winslet's like, I've got a great idea. I'm going to rope you into it because you're tall and handsome, even though I'm going to get married tomorrow. We're going to charter this plane that's being flown by Beau Bridges.
And his dog.
And his dog's not flying the plane, though. But
he's co-piloting the plane.
That's also a spoiler, David.
His incredible, incredible golden Labrador, the greatest boy, is riding in the cabin.
Air Bud.
And he is truly Air Bud. And Beau Bridges strokes out a little bit in the air, and the plane crashes, and he dies, and it's just the puppy, and he's not really a puppy, but you know, the pupster.
He's very cute.
And Idris Elba, who's pretty intact, and Kate Winslet, whose leg's all fucked up, on top of this mountain, and they gotta trust each other and figure out one of their wants. She's sort of reckless and impulsive, and he is more of an introvert. He also very obviously is harboring a secret of some kind. And they shuffle their way down the mountain.
And they have to keep each other warm.
I don't know. You gotta pay the money. Gotta pay the money for the ticket if you want to find out these things.
So David, when I saw this movie, I, you know, hadn't read any reviews. I was kind of didn't know how harrowing it was going to be because they kept talking about like they were filming on a real mountain and it was going to be really intense.
They shot it at 11,000 feet above the air. That is incredible.
It is incredible. But then there was a point where like the dog above was getting a lot of reaction shots and I was like, oh, okay. I feel relieved. Like this is not going to be The Revenant. No one's going to have to like, you know, sew up their own wounds. And I kind of enjoyed it. It felt like the... I want to say it's an airplane movie, which is ironic because it centers on a plane crash, but it seems like something I would enjoy immensely on TNT.
That sounds... Maybe on... I don't think it's like actiony enough for the TNT crowd. Maybe like the Lifetime crowd if they splurge for a bigger budgeted movie.
Lifetime debut of Grace of Monaco?
Yes. I mean, this is definitely... for all the survivalist rugged elements, it definitely is more of a romantic melodrama than anything else. And just to use the words romantic melodrama, I am not implying that they fuck or do not fuck. I'm just saying that there is a clear romantic tension between the two of them. Even though they are increasingly hypothermic and on the brink of death, there is always time to feast your eyes on Idris Elba's body. He's a very good looking man. And so on, and have great shots of they never name the, they don't know the dog's name because they never learned it. And so Idris Elba just calls him dog, and it's a beautiful story. You know what this movie is, just hearing us talking about it. You know if you need to spend the night of your life watching it. If you choose to do so, I think you might find that it's a little bit longer than you might have hoped, but plenty entertaining, I guess. Entertaining enough. A bit silly.
I look forward to seeing the rest of it.
Yeah, you could definitely do a lot worse. If you really have no interest in seeing Blade Runner, if you get to the theater and have somehow, some reason, not bought tickets in advance and Blade Runner is sold out, and you don't live somewhere where the Florida Project or Faces Places is playing, why not?
Why not? That's your pull quote on the poster.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down.
You can stand me up. I feel like I've seen a lot. Like, I don't think I'm a full Ryan Gosling completist. Like, all his, like, mid-aughts stuff. One he made with Sandra Bullock.
I mean, there aren't that many Ryan Gosling movies.
No, I know. I'm just realizing. Like, I feel like I've seen a whole lot of them.
Yeah, well, that's good. That'll help you in this kind of
stuff. Like, I've never saw The Believer, Never Call Murder by Numbers, United States of
Lincoln. And I saw her face.
Fracture.
You never saw Murder by Numbers?
No. What is Stay?
What were you doing in high school?
Oh, I saw Stay.
Written by David Benioff.
Oh, yeah. Shot at Columbia.
This week, Blade Runner 2049 hits theaters, the long-awaited sequel to Blade Runner. Harrison Ford is back. But who's the real star of Blade Runner 2049? Isn't it Ryan Gosling?
It's definitely Roger Deakins, but I'll continue.
That's probably true.
I have seen Blade Runner 2049, and it is not a spoiler to say that the literal star of the movie is unequivocally Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling, you're all over this movie. But, I mean, I don't feel like people are talking about Ryan Gosling, necessarily. And I don't feel like people talk about Ryan Gosling very much. He's kind of like, he's always
Papyrus.
There. He's always there in his movies. Actually, SNL this past weekend was one of his best performances, but we'll get there. I want to know what you guys make of Ryan Gosling. I think he's a bigger star in the grand scheme of things. I don't know if he's a bankable star. I don't know if anyone's a bankable star, really. If Channing Tatum can't open Logan Lucky, who's a star these days? Leonardo DiCaprio. But Ryan Gosling, you know, he's been steadily working since, what, 2005, 2004, when The Notebook came out. That's when he kind of blew up. He'd done some small stuff. He was Young Hercules for a while in the mid-90s. I guess he was a Mickey Mouse Club guy,
He was.
And then he did a Goosebumps episode. I remember that.
He did Drive, Young the Ides of March, Young the Place Beyond the Pines.
He grew up into those roles later. Yeah. But obviously, he blew up. He was in Remember the Titans. He had The Notebook. And then he's just become this like prominent actor. I feel like he is revered for being one of his generation's best. But I don't really get that. He, for me, he really floats through movies. I don't know what he adds to a movie. I'm never walking out of a Ryan Gosling movie saying, man, that was a phenomenal Ryan Gosling performance. He threw himself in there. I think he picks the right projects and he works with the right people, but that he is some non-entity that's kind of like James Francoian to me, as opposed, even, but like Franco at least commits and goes crazy with characters every once in a while. But like Ryan Gosling always seems like the work he's doing is a joke, or that he's not, he's just going to go with it. What is Ryan Gosling? That's the name of this segment.
I feel like I would have said exactly that about James Franco. There is always like some level of irony in James Franco for the last 10 years or so. But Gosling, I always feel like overcommits, and he's always got like four different things he's doing with the characters to make him a character. And
really?
Like, doing kind of a lot of diving in there. And that's always where
Are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Blue Valentine mostly. Like that movie was him kind of like, you know, like beating himself in the head, trying to get this girl to love him. And it was just a lot. I don't remember Half Nelson that well, but I seem to remember it being there. I really like Lars and the Real Girl, but he's doing a whole lot there. And when I like
the mustache. Sorry, I thought you were done. Well, but you were swallowing.
When I like him best is just when he is kind of being more of like a movie star guy. I think he's really good in Crazy Stupid Love. I think he's really good in The Big Short, La La Land, La La Land 2, but I meant The Nice Guys. Not necessarily my favorite movies, but those are the ones where I think he's the best.
He seems to have, you know, he came up and the rap on him was sort of that he was Brando reincarnate. And, you know, you remember those early roles, and it always felt like a little bit of a curveball when he did something a little bit more mainstream appeal, like The Notebook, was that, you know, he was that intense, inscrutable, mumbly type, young, grace with good looks, et cetera. And it seems like once he directed Lost River, which never found an audience and is
never
kind
will
of up its own, yeah, never will. It's kind of up its own butthole. And he was doing like the whole like brooding artist thing. He had his band, even, I remember.
What? What was his band?
Yeah. He had a band?
Man, they were like Pitchfork certified and everything. His band was called, I've got it right here, Dead Man's Bones.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's no 30 odd foot of grunt, but I'll take
it. No, they were actually much better than 30 odd foot of grunt.
Yes, star.
And then during The Nice Guys, they cut that scene out where their two bands had a battle of the bands. But he, I feel like in recent years, he has been a little bit lighter. You know, there's definitely a comedic bent to Big Short, Nice Guys, La La Land. Song to Song is its own thing, but that was filmed a zillion years ago.
Does he actually have dialogue in it? It's usually the problem in those.
He did. There's more dialogue than you think in Song to Song, at least more compared to the recent Terrence Malick movies. But again, he's a pawn in Malick's game, as many are.
And in 2049, in Blade Runner 2049, you know, he plays it's a Denis Villeneuve movie. He's definitely similar to what Deckard's character was like in the original Blade Runner. He's sort of terse. He does get a joke or two, which he sticks. But I definitely feel like he's gone a little bit lighter.
Do you think that serves him well?
It certainly served him well culturally. I don't know if he feels more fulfilled, but I don't know the guy.
Well, I always wonder. Do you think he's better as an actor? Because that's what's kind of sold me. Is like,
right. Okay.
Like,
so that's the right. I feel like he's never been bad in a movie. Like, I've never seen a movie with Ryan Gosling and be like, he duffed that. And his, whatever choice he made, totally derailed the movie. I mean, he's interested in working with interesting filmmakers, and he tends to be pretty flexible in doing what they need him to do. I think he has a pretty consistent energy that most of the people who choose to work with him know how to tap into. You know, you get a lot of actors this way. I actually think the same thing about Harrison Ford. It was like, I don't know. He's been great for certain roles. I don't know if he's necessarily a great actor.
I tend to agree with that.
You know, he's sort of, he's a tool. He does what I don't mean that in like the Carson Daly way.
I think Ford has more swagger. I think Ford is better at playing himself than Gosling is. I think Gosling ends up defaulting to this non-entity where it makes his comedic stuff where he can just go really broad. It's really funny. But again, I don't know if, Katie, you were kind of alluding to this. I don't know if that makes him a great actor or not. You know, he can have a mustache and fall down in The Nice Guys and I'm laughing, and he can be on SNL and be cracking up. I mean, SNL's the perfect example. He couldn't hold a seat. He couldn't stop laughing. He's in on his own joke. He seems very self-aware. And The Nice Guys draws upon that instinct to be like, this is nuts, and I'm going to get to play nuts. But well, could he
but when
be
he does in
comedic?
Crazy, yeah. I think that's what Crazy Stupid Love is. I think he's very light in that, but he's not the funny character. Like, Emma Stone's kind of doing all the jokes, and he's being, like, a normal, handsome, suave guy, which I think serves him really well. And it makes me think about Brad Pitt, who I think did a lot of the same, like, trying to do a whole lot when he was really acting. And then only much later in his career has settled into kind of like being, you know, you think of his performance in Moneyball and you're like, oh, he's been able to do this all along. He just needed to chill out a little bit. And I think Gosling maybe is like Brad Pitt, like has a hard time with like the hunky dude thing. But when he leans into it, it serves him.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really good diagnosis to me. I think he has always seemed a little uncomfortable with his looks. I remember he seems sort of bashful in it's always pointless to read into these things, the veil of like what you see on screen versus what it means to the actor playing it. But I definitely got a vibe of bashfulness in Crazy Sexy Love, Crazy Stupid Love, whatever the fuck it's called, when they take off his shirt and Emma Stone's like, you look photoshopped. You know, I think that, yeah, it doesn't always suit him. I think there's sort of an aw shucks feeling about him, which I never would have predicted back in the Murder by Numbers days, or the Believer, you know, the Believer when he's playing a Jewish neo-Nazi. This is, but he seems to be leaning into that. He seems to be enjoying it. I don't know. I think,
but see, I think he's more of a, I think he's more of a Clooney type.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Clooney and like thinking about the best Clooney roles.
The Ides of March.
Oh, right. Totally forgot about that. But, he reminds me of Clooney because Clooney can play himself and up the swagger. He can do the Ocean's 11 thing, but he can be Michael Clayton. You know, that's one of my favorite Clooney roles. It's like, it's kind of stoic, it's observational. But then it can be ferocious. I actually think of one of my favorite Ryan Gosling roles might be the movie Fracture. You remember that with Anthony Hopkins?
With A-Hops.
Kind of legal thriller. Something that's a little heightened that still requires, you know, commitment and the theatrics of movie making as opposed to the naturalism of Half Nelson and Blue Valentine, where I think he is better. He can play himself. He can mumble his way through these movies and be the bashful kind of persona that you're picking up there. But what I don't see him enough, and like when I think he could make a bigger impact in movies if he just would lean in to the stardom a little bit, to be a bigger presence. I think he could be better in La La Land. I think he could be more fun in The Nice Guys. And I think he could be in a movie like Only God Forgives, where he is truly just like the object of Nicholas Winding Refn's affection, to be the center of a frame.
Can you prescribe a way that he could be better in The Nice Guys? Is there like an example other than, and don't say like his singing voice, because that's what it is.
Oh, wait, in The Nice Guys or La La Land?
No, in La La Land.
Oh, in La La Land. I just think that that character could come down to earth, even though the movie is fantasy. I think he could feel lived in as opposed to, I mean, the whole movie is about conventions. It's about archetypes. But I think that he has the power to have a little bit more swagger in the moments that he's getting jazzy. He doesn't have to be – he has a very stoic face. And I think he could do more with it. But he chooses to be this kind of like dead-eyed blank canvas for whatever the director is doing. It's the opposite of someone like Leo, who seems to be contemplating and like living
Leo
in
who?
The character. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Close personal.
Yeah, Leo, baby, give me the face. I don't know. You
give
don't think
me
you could
the face?
Is there a way to give more to these movies, or do people cast Ryan Gosling because he will give you that blank canvas? Maybe that's what people look for. You project on Ryan Gosling.
I think that's what La La Land definitely called for. I mean, the problem with me and with his character in La La Land is just the way that he's written. I don't think there's much you can do with the guy who's like kind of unrealistically fixated on what jazz means. And this is what drives me crazy about the movie for both of them is that they both have dumb dreams that they shouldn't pursue.
But he saves jazz.
He does save jazz. I mean, I don't know if we want how much we want to talk about him on SNL, but I found I thought not only was he funny in a lot of his sketches, but the way that he was cracking up, not at himself, but about his co-stars and mostly the women he was in the scenes with, was super endearing.
But how do you watch that and not feel like your take on Ryan Gosling is affected by something like that? I mean, like just like looking at all of his performances through that lens, I feel like it's hard to It's hard to do that. It's like, you know, he could be a little bit more of an inscrutable character, retain more of an air of mystery, which is something he's abandoned a long time ago, if he didn't do things like SNL, but he wants to and he does, and it changes how you see him.
Yeah.
And that's then, why DiCaprio will never do SNL. He'll only stop by Jonah Hill's episodes.
Yeah, he's never done SNL, right?
No.
Yeah,
I don't think he could. I don't think he could.
No, I don't think
break
he could either.
The facade. Yeah,
because he's like too important for us. I mean, like he would have to do it in order to promote, you know, something about the ozone layer or something. Do we have an ozone layer anymore? I don't even know.
Probably
but that's
not.
What's
probably
so not. Weird about Gosling, because when he was doing Blue Valentine, and then when he did Place Beyond the Pines, this whole like Derek Cianfrance moment in his career, it was all about that method acting. It was all about living in it and getting down and dirty and going to these locations and you know, practicing on the stunt bike or whatever, or living in a house with Michelle Williams. It was so committed and so serious. And actually what he's lacking is like genuine seriousness. I want that monolithic I guess there's an element of machismo but I want that from actresses too. I love that. I love commitment.
I mean, I love commitment, but like, I think that was a fear in his life, but I think he's finding, you know, more comfort. And I think him offering that kind of like there aren't a lot of actors who could have done La La Land. Like, I think he has a really specific niche that he's occupying really well, and he'd be foolish to give up on it.
I could have done La La Land.
I see it. I can see it.
Another thing about his persona that I like is that he and Eva Mendes fell in love on a movie that no one remembers, and they're just married and having kids, and like, just doing it and like not talking about it and not taking their kids out. And
are they married though?
I think they got married, didn't they? Or they at least have.
They're not Wikipedia married, so they may be real married.
Eva Mendes is also someone who I always thought got a worse rap than she deserved. And
that Ghost Rider will do that to you.
Together. I know. No, she's really good in We Own the Night, which is like 10 years old at this point.
She's also, she's 43 and he's 36. Huh? She's a bit older than he is. She was named by People Magazine in 2012 the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful at every age.
Is that a backhanded compliment? What is that? It seems rude.
I guess it means that she's not 25, but still beautiful. I don't know. It's possible that people can be such
rude
things, apparently, if you're in People magazine. But she has not acted in a film since Lost River, which Ryan Gosling directed.
They have a family.
They do.
I think they have a family, and she got offered a lot of shitty roles.
Yeah, I mean, I can only hope when I look at something like that she has not been working by choice and not because Hollywood decided that as a mother at ancient age of 43 that she has already been aged out of having a career. But
that seems crazy.
She is the creative director of the makeup brand Circa Beauty, which launched exclusively at Walgreens in 2015.
Well, all right.
I forgot that she was in Holy Motors, too.
We're getting way off track here. Final words on Ryan Gosling.
Yes or no? Is Ryan Gosling Ryan Gosling?
Is Ryan Gosling
a good actor?
Yes.
Is every Ryan Gosling movie a variant of Drive?
I don't know.
No.
Batches, yes or no? Is Ryan Gosling a good actor?
Yes. Ryan Gosling.
A begrudging yes.
Is he good in Blade Runner?
I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's the conversation we're having. Like, would I remember him? Be like, you know who really stood out in Blade Runner? Ryan Gosling. No. But can I imagine doing the role that he does in Blade Runner considerably better in a way that would improve the movie? Also, no.
I like that our standard for good actor is, could David be better at it?
No, I didn't. I wasn't saying, could I be better?
Look, can I see myself chasing replicants? Yes, I can. Do I see myself chasing them better than Ryan Gosling? No.
The best part about me being in Blade Runner 2049 would be that I would never be able to watch Blade Runner 2049, and that would be just fine. I think he is totally serviceable in the movie.
He's a great prop. He's a great prop.
Yes, yes.
He makes sense in movies, visionary movies, because
let us remember that just Harrison Ford in the original Blade Runner is fine.
Yeah, no, Harrison Ford, he is doing The character he plays in this movie is a Blade Runner, but is very different in a lot of ways than Harrison Ford's character in Blade Runner. However, they give very similar performances that are have roughly the same emotional range. Yeah, it's a great analogy.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week with Dave back, and I think we'll be talking about Blade Runner 2049, which is exciting. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes and share them with friends, which you should definitely do, or you can leave comments on anything we talked about. We'll check out the site and get back to you with answers. And remember that we're also giving away a two Blu-ray copies of A Ghost Story. Leave iTunes reviews to do that.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at IndieWire.com, where if you're excited for Blade Runner 2049, I've ranked all of Denis Villeneuve's movies. That slots in there somewhere. You can find all of us together on Facebook and Fighting in the War Room, and you can join us in calling your senators and our senators if you like, and asking for better gun control / demanding. Why not? Let's get political. It's an outro. It's my space. I can do what I want.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRACH. And we're all on Twitter talking to you and each other at FITWR, where you can also answer this week's lightning round question. Patches, give me that noise again.
In honor of Blade Runner 2049, at least according to David's feelings, or maybe Blade Runner the original, according to many, many people's feelings, what is the best looking bad movie?
Oh, hang on.
Oh, that's the end of the podcast. Yawny pants.
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Hi, guys, it's Dave. I wasn't on the podcast, but I do agree with David that regardless, if you want to get involved with the gun control issue right now in the United States, you could call your U.S. representatives by dialing 202-225-3121 and your U.S. senators by calling 202-224-3121. Let's make sure our voices are heard, if you want. You don't have to. You can just watch Blade Runner. It's fun. I want a glad.